Hi, it's me, Evan. Really quick, before we start today's show, twice a year, we shorten our show so that we can spend time on air asking listeners like you to pledge your support to Good Food. Since you're listening via podcast, you might not have heard me and my colleagues on air asking for your dollars or even known that the show is produced by a public radio station. So here's my quick pitch to you. If you love Good Food, and why else would you be listening via podcast, then show us your support by becoming a member of KCRW today. You can even do it right now. If you're by your computer or your iPad, go to kcrw.com/join. If you're in the car, pull over, pause this message, and dial 1-800-600-KCRW. That's 1-800-600-5279. If you've pledged before, it's a great time to renew your monthly membership. We depend on you to support us, just like you depend on us for weekly restaurant reviews from Jonathan Gold and all the recipes and food news we share on the Good Food blog. If you've heard me say it before and you didn't act, please don't miss your chance this time around. Go to kcrw.com/join. Support KCRW as a monthly member or do what I do and pledge as an advocate. That's a dollar a day to support the programming that you love. Whatever amount you give, I personally want to say thanks. Now, on to the show. From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. We kick off this week's show with our weekly restaurant recommendation from Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Jonathan, where are you taking us this week?
It's a new restaurant called Vespertine, which I think I can confidently say is the most extreme restaurant in the world right now. We're lucky to have it right here in Culver City. I usually go more than a couple of times, but it's really expensive.
$500 a person?
It's a 250 base, and then you add tax, and you add the tip, and then beverages are on top of that. So the juice pairing is 70, and I think the wine pairing is 200.
So much has been made of the fact that it's this Eric Owen Moss building, as many buildings are in that area of Culver City, that's kind of latticey and undulating to the sky. How does the meal start?
It's almost less talking about the meal than it is talking about the experience, because I think that more than any restaurant I've ever been to, it's almost impossible to isolate the actual things you eat from the actual environment that you're eating it in. So you get there, you're greeted by name by the guy parking the cars, which is sometimes disconcerting. You're ushered to a lobby, you go up an elevator, which opens into the kitchen, at which, you know, Chef Jordan Kahn. Jordan has greeted you. You go up another flight of stairs to this, like an airy or an eagle's nest or this place up at the top that's all glassed in. You can see all the way from the Malibu Mountains to the San Gabriel Mountains downtown. You see the metro train going through the skyline over the big bridge, like something out of that movie Her a couple of years ago. It's futurist Los Angeles.
I have to ask you, is this initial experience meant to punctuate the difference from your regular life into this liminal space in which you find yourself for a few hours?
It could be. I mean, the entire restaurant has a very minimal soundtrack. You have the ceramic vessels by a Japanese sculptor. The first one may be like white Asiatic dayflower petals. Do you know what an Asiatic dayflower is?
No.
I don't either. But there are these petals, and they're arranged in sort of the shape of a torch blossom on top of a sliver of ripe Japanese melons that's been smeared with salted plum jam. When you finish that, a waitress like flips it. On the bottom side, there's bougainvillea leaves. Did you know you could eat bougainvillea leaves?
I had no idea.
I had no idea either. But they're like glued with a gel of beets and Concord grapes inside a cavity underneath. Somebody shows up with this, I guess it's a pottery arch. All of this is like black, pebbly, super dense. And eventually somebody brings a black hoop that fits into it. Inside that hoop, there's a hoop made of, I guess, a big toasted kelp chip shaped into a circle that's glued to it with sort of a salty cream.
While you're experiencing this, are you hearing exclamations of surprise by other people, or is it a hush?
It's pretty hushed. I think in the first few months, and this may change, people didn't know what to expect. And when somebody comes to your table and they put down something that looks like the monolith from 2001, except there's a notch cut out of it, and inside the notch is cured mango that has been sort of laminated with sunflower petals, you don't know what to make of it, right? It's completely different from anything outside your experience.
So then when you finally go downstairs, does the progression of dishes become anything more familiar?
No. In fact, the first dish that you're given after that is, I guess, flounder. Sometimes he calls it like weird flounder, or harame would be the Japanese thing. It's a flatfish. I think it's pounded. It's dyed absolutely jet black with burnt onion. When you first get it in its black bowl, it looks like an empty bowl. You can't tell that there's anything inside of it. You almost wonder for a second what you're supposed to do. Then you sort of tap and you figure out that it's fleshy and you break through it and there's like a porridge underneath. The idea is you don't really know what you're eating.
So is this an Emperor Has No Clothes experience, or is this a kind of fascinating art project?
Well, it's perfect. I mean, every effect that they're trying for, they achieve. The cooking doesn't slip. You never say, oh, this is overcooked or this is undercooked or what are they doing combining pea ice with smoked bone marrow. It all works in the way it's supposed to work, I think. But I think it's also supposed to keep you off guard. For example, there's that dish of like smoked bone marrow with braised leek hearts, which I swear I didn't know were leek hearts. They didn't taste like leeks. They didn't crunch like leeks. I thought it was actually eggplant because it was much softer than that. There was a plum broth or a broth that was inflected by umeboshi, the Japanese pickled apricot they call plums. There was a sprinkling of herbs over the top, one of which was wormwood leaves.
Which is the stuff that was in absinthe that used to make people go crazy.
Right, or was rumored to make people go crazy. Have you ever tasted wormwood leaf?
Isn't it one of the most bitter substances on the planet?
It is so insanely bitter. I had no idea what it was. Anyway, the idea that you're eating an herb that you've never had that's so powerful on top of taste that you have had just sort of skews something. There was like an orange smear on that dish. And I thought it was chicken liver, but it might have been pureed mussels. And it could have been foie gras. And it was so changed from what it had originally been that all you knew is that you didn't know what it was.
I mean, this is a very, very particular restaurant, obviously, when you say it's the most extreme restaurant right now in the world. Is it important that this place exists?
I think it's really important. I mean, Los Angeles has not had restaurants like this before. That as good as the food in Los Angeles is, and we both agree it's some of the best cooking in the world, we've never had anything that even sort of like sniffed at the upper end of the world's best restaurant thing. And this sort of might, because it's playing in a different league. Is it necessary to go to art exhibitions? Is it necessary to go to the opera? I think it's something that anybody who really cares about food or probably cares about art should experience.
That's LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold talking about Vespertine in Culver City. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. 6 years ago, Joseph Centeno opened his restaurant Baco Mercat in a 110-year-old Italian Renaissance revival building in downtown LA. Today, Centeno's the culinary mayor of the historic core. He owns 5 restaurants there, and he's just opened the fast casual Baco shop in Culver City. Centeno's first cookbook also just hit the stands. It's called Baco.
It's really a book as a guide, because I've never followed a recipe until I wrote the book.
You're lucky that your co-author was your wife, Betty Halleck, who has a lot of experience making really perfect recipes. I really have to ask you, since I feel like your tenure, since you opened your own place, is sort of the tenure of the scene in downtown LA. Talk about how the culinary scene has changed since you first opened.
I'd always wanted to be in downtown, having worked in New York and in the Bay Area, having that city experience, the edgy grittiness was always important for me as far as being able to cook in that element. Once I opened Lazy Ox, and then I opened Baco Mercat, I saw LA as it had already been for like artists and writers and was pretty much inhabited by
the creative class.
And that's what made it so attractive. And just being able to be a part of that element was important. So when I opened Baco Mercat, it seemed like after the first year, like kind of this new generation of restaurants started to open, which was exciting. And the melting pot that Los Angeles is and is very similar to like what I grew up in San Antonio is my whole family, my whole heritage is so diverse. And it felt like home.
Yeah, and I feel like your trajectory has been the trajectory of feeding the people around you. So as the daily audience has expanded, it's allowed you to expand into other points of view on the plate.
My whole foundation was fine dining. And when I moved to LA back in 2004, fine dining was like really not the game to be playing. And it was like I had to start all over as the line cook and work my way up when I had already
did that.
But what I realized was that in itself was opportunity because there wasn't like a predetermined playing field.
You use flavors from all over the place with such exuberance and restraint at the same time. It's like you really understand what the flavors are. Could you talk a bit about that?
Baco is a book about flavor, and it's about a flavor that I have worked on for all of my cooking career, but it even goes back further because, like I had mentioned, growing up in San Antonio, my family being so diverse from Mexican, Spanish, German, French, English, Polish, I was exposed to so many different types of cooking growing up. You almost have to train your palate to understand what you think is delicious, but what you think you'll be able to translate to the people that you're cooking for. So it was important for me to be able to develop my palate and what I thought was going to be the flavors that would excite people.
Could you talk about the period of time before you started traveling when it was just something that you read in a book and you imagined flavors in your mind?
Cookbooks and imagination were so important for my development. I didn't travel out of the country until I was like almost 38. Me traveling was moving to New York to cook. And when I went to New York, it was working 6-7 days, 18 hours a day. And there was no energy or money because the pay was so poor. So after working all day, I would go home and I'd go through every single book. I mean, and I was traveling around New York with like 25 boxes of books.
It's like a DJ with records.
It was like insane. And I mean, it was the only way that I was able to like escape. There wasn't any internet or Instagram. You had a book with either sketches of the food or just a list of ingredients. For me, it was like Sabastada when I first encountered that. It was literally a list of ingredients. It was tomato and almond and parsley and lemon and cherry vinegar and olive oil. You flip that to the other side of the world, and that could be pico de gallo if you add cilantro.
One of the things you also do that really, I think, is what makes your food really accessible and really embraced is the way you combine high flavor with richness. Could you talk a bit about that?
I think I would attribute that to my fine dining training and I guess always wanting to use those techniques. Like right now at PYT, we're doing Tehachapi grain porridge. We're milling it ourselves and we'll mount it with a little bit of French butter. We'll add like pickled cherries and a little bit of sardo pecorino and finish with a little bit of olive oil and some thyme and lovage.
That's so complex for something that you look at and you think is just a bowl of comfort. Bako the book, give us something that we could make going into fall.
The Bako book is not necessarily Bako Mercat, the restaurant. It's Bako more as an idea about flavor. In the book, we have the Brussels sprouts, which is a very popular dish at the restaurant. If you go a couple of pages over, there's a walnut bagnacotta, and we're coming up on red walnuts in the next couple of months, and they usually come out of Livermore, and they're amazing. It's something that you could easily do with just a knife and a cutting board and a saute pan and some olive oil and garlic and anchovy.
Chef Joseph Centeno owns 5 restaurants in downtown LA and 1 in Culver City. His first cookbook, which he wrote with his wife Betty Halleck, is called Bako, Vivid Recipes from the Heart of Los Angeles. Race is complicated, and talking about it can be uncomfortable. But Nigerian-American chef Tunde Wey confronts dialogues about race head-on. The last time he was in the studio, Wey talked about his series Blackness in America. Last month, Wey wrote an essay about whiteness in the restaurant industry for the San Francisco Chronicle. You start out with this sentence, "Let food forever be the metaphor and food stories the allegory." What do you mean when you say that, and how does it relate to our current political and social climate?
I think that often we are looking for the best, most hassle-free answer to really complicated questions. We're looking for an argument that makes sense on all sides. I think that food is this like perfect place where we can approach difficult topics and conversations, and we don't necessarily have to have the conversation or the argument or the point be tidy, because tidiness doesn't exist in real life. It's messy. And so food, I think, allows that to happen.
One of the most interesting things about the essay in which you sort of bring this idea to the forefront for me was how you compared a restaurant in New Orleans, which you currently call home, which was Bon Appetit's top pick for best new restaurant in the country. And you sort of look at what that restaurant is and you take the thread that what if that had been a restaurant conceived in the Black community?
Yeah, we live in a society where race plays a significant role. The Bon Appetit pick is proof of that, that a restaurant in the style and in the sort of like aesthetic sentiment of Turkey and the Wolf, which is the restaurant that was picked as the best new restaurant, is lauded. But there's so many other restaurants owned by non-white people in that same style that never get the acknowledgement or the look. You know, we are sort of fed the idea that there's a certain like aesthetic or a certain expectation that gets unrewarded. But the truth is, it's neither the expectation nor the style nor the aesthetic nor the approach. It's the ideology which validates and highlights whiteness. That is what is rewarded over and over again. And when other non-white ideas, non-white perspectives and people are recognized, is usually in a tokenized fashion. And I think this is something that we have to be honest and address if we want things to change as we say we do.
You know, it's so interesting for me to think about this because I think about restaurants that we go to and we love because they have a, quote, authenticity to them, or they're connected. They're connected in some way to a culture, a deep culture. And so we respond to them because we're being fed something that is real. And then there's the kind of restaurant that is very popular now, which is very meta. It borrows from a real culture, but sits above it. And those are the restaurants that are getting the attention. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
I think you have more experience in this field than I do, so I would defer to you. But I would say that I recognize what you're saying, you know, and I think there's a space for those kinds of restaurants. You know, restaurants that are that permit a certain kind of abstraction, right? That lets you be present as you eat the meal, but also lets you sort of like recognize something different, like sort of like look outside of yourself in that space. And I think that's wonderful. I think what is missing from those restaurants and from a lot of restaurants is that whether we are serving abstractions or we're serving critiques or we're just serving entertainment, there is no morality. There is nothing there besides this vacuous comment. we are in a place where we can't afford to be neutral or to not have a position. It is important to me and the work that I do and the, sort of like the dining spaces that I try to create to inject a morality, to inject a point of view, because we are all politicized, whether we choose to accept it or not. And the people who generally don't want to recognize their politics are the people who have the privilege not to. And so whatever sort of personal privilege or influence that I have, my goal is to direct all of that to politicizing spaces that haven't been and that choose not to be, so that we can all sort of like lay it out on the table and say, this is who we are and this is what we must change if we want to change, again, like we say we do.
Find a link to the essay Tunde Wei wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle. It's called Look to the Food World to Understand America's White Supremacy Problem. It's on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Now it's time for the market report. Let's see what Laura Avery's shopping for this week.
I'm talking with chef owner Royce Burke, who owns a restaurant in Chinatown called Secret Lasagna. And Royce, you're here at the market shopping.
I'm looking for a lot of the fresh herbs that I use. As opposed to just a Italian pork sausage lasagna, we also incorporate a 7-hour slow-braised beef that's braised with a whole bunch of different French herbs, rosemary, thyme. We use a lot of sage in our garlic bread, and we also have an Ethiopian spice burger on the menu that uses fresh mint and fresh onions and parsley and a little bit of lemon basil for a balsamic chimichurri that goes on top.
Royce, you mentioned the Moroccan, you mentioned the Italian, the French, and this all seems to be influenced by the herb you use and then your basic tomato sauce. Can you take the tomato sauce in multiple directions based on the herbs?
You can. One of the key ingredients in my tomato sauce, I use a Puerto Rican spiced vinegar that I make in-house. It's called pique. And I do my own twist on it using a lot more Thai chilies, specifically the green ones, because they have a really herbal dimension that I've used a lot during my time cooking Thai food. And it brings an added like brightness and herbaceousness to everything. But you see so many cultural crossovers with herbs. And one of my most memorable meals I've ever had was in Paris in a little mom-and-pop cafe in Montmartre. It was the last place open. It was 11:30 and I was starving. And my wife and I walked in and I had a rabbit stew. It was a really solid, just delicious, hearty rabbit stew. But the thing that blew my mind was the first layer was all that really rich, fatty deliciousness, the vegetables, the rabbit. And then you got hit right on the back of the palate with star anise, which shocked me because star anise is such a dominant herb.
Royce, can you tell us what is in your vegan lasagna?
I've never wanted to do vegan food that was just made to mimic meat flavors. I do a couple different types of vegan cheese using cashews and extra from tofu, basil, pique, nutritional yeast, all these other delicious ingredients. But I wanted the texture of ricotta because I think it's very important to a lasagna, which is why I did the cashew-based ricotta. The flavor isn't trying to mimic ricotta cheese. It's its own thing. It has a strong basil flavor. And then the topping cashew-based cheese we use incorporates this, you know, Puerto Rican spice vinegar. And then besides that, we use several different kinds of roasted mushrooms inside of there. Grilled and roasted zucchini. Oh, crazy. Grilled carrots. The flavor you get when you char carrots is outrageously out of this world. It's this sweet, nutty, crazy flavor.
And this sounds like something definitely we need to come down and check out. Jerry Ruta's farm from Arroyo Grande is one of the farms that grows a lot of the herbs that Royce was just talking about. The herbs that you grow, thyme
we have. What thyme is it, did you say? Italian flatleaf parsley. We have French tarragon also. Spearmint. Cilantro.
When you try to buy herbs in a grocery store, you get those tiny, tiny, tiny little containers of herbs, and you sell them by these nice big bunches.
Well, when you buy them in the grocery store, the container is probably more value than the herb that's inside of it. So we just use a very simple bunch, and the trick is trying to get it to last as well. Those containers are made so that they will last for 2 or 3 weeks after they're harvested. So with our herbs, we usually will harvest them on Tuesday and we'll bring them down here and sell them on Wednesday, and hopefully people will use them the next day or so.
What if I take them home and stick them in a jar of water and put them in my fridge?
The jar of water will probably get tipped over and make a mess in your refrigerator. And one good way, if you do buy a bunch of herbs, is to go ahead and take it home, take the twisty tie off of it. Don't wash it, but try to dry it off so there's not any free moisture, and put it into a Tupperware container and seal it. And it will last a good week in your refrigerator. That helps quite a bit.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Jerry. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
That's it for this week's show. You can listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also download Good Food wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give a shout out to all the Good Food team for the hard work that goes into producing this show. So here they are. It's Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, Rosalie Atkinson, Joel Stein, Michelle Escobar, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to share your support with us. Go online to kcrw.com/join or call those magic numbers, 1-800-600-KCRW. That's 1-800-600-5279. And thanks. We wouldn't be here without you. Seriously. I'll be back next week with an hour-long show you won't want to miss.